Good evening. I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. Later on tonight, I will have several conversations about the revelations, a few of the revelations in Clinton Cash, Peter Schweitzer's new book. It speaks to how the Clinton Foundation conducted its business not only since the President of the United States left office in 2001, but especially since the candidate for the presidency in 2016, Mrs. Clinton, became the Secretary of State. In those conversations, we explore in different directions the possibilities for the Clintons now that Mr. Clinton is coming out speaking about how he had to pay the bills and he just worked there. A lot of which I have to say are facile remarks, but there is depth to this. And tonight, Gordon Chang of Forbes.com joins me because we're going to surprise everyone. We're going to start illustrating the puzzle of India, the puzzle to Prime Minister Modi, a year in office, by mentioning what corruption really means in India. This is Sarah Westwood, whom I will speak to later. Sarah Westwood's report in the Washington Times about Clinton Cash. This item pops up right away. Indian money began to flow to the philanthropy, to the Clinton Global Initiative, after a bill that would have softened restrictions on nuclear trade with the country met resistance in Congress. This is early in the Obama administration. At that time, this is before Mr. Obama was president, when Mrs. Clinton was senator from New York, before she ran for the higher office in 2008. At that time, then New York Senator Hillary Clinton was an opponent of the legislation. A man by the name of Amar Singh, a member of India's parliament at the time, he might be now, I do not know, poured money into the Clinton Foundation. He donated between $1 and $5 million. Even though it was later learned that his entire net worth was $5 million. Mrs. Clinton met with a two-hour dinner with Amar Singh in 2008. This is according to Peter Schweitzer's reporting, in September of 2008. And Singh, at that time, told the Indian media that Mrs. Clinton had told him that she would not block the nuclear deal and that she supported it, the support he needed for it to pass. It did go through. Mr. Singh later asked about the money, since it would have been his entire fortune for this opportunity to have dinner with Hillary Clinton, said the payment could have been made by someone else on Mr. Singh's behalf, end quote. There is Indian corruption in 2008, and we now turn to 2015 in Indian corruption. We're joined by Cleo Pascal, Associate Fellow in Energy, Environment, and Resources at the Chatham House. Cleo, beg pardon for taking so long, but I thought that we'd connect all the dots here. The corruption that Mr. Singh represents, I don't know where the money came from. It was a good dinner. That corruption Mr. Modi has taken on in his first year in office. How's he doing? Good evening to you.
Good evening. It's a very tough fight. It's pretty endemic, and billions are at stake. So the groups lined up against him are pretty strong. And he's taken it a little bit slow at the beginning for various reasons. But he's been doing some things that are very quiet, but hopefully very effective. For example, they busted a big corporate espionage ring. What the previous government had been doing was classifying economic documents that shouldn't have been classified, and then members in the government or in the administration were selling that data to corporate houses to give them a corporate advantage. And the corporate houses were leaking bad news about competitors or officials who were trying to be honest to the media to try to knock them out that way. So just to give you a little taste of kind of the embedded corruption that he came into power that he had to deal with. And just on the Clinton issue, the Clinton Foundation issue, from the Indian side, one of the big concerns is the money that went into the Clinton Foundation from China and the Middle East. So they're concerned that that money could affect the U.S.'s policies towards India. So there's everybody seemed to know this thing was kind of going on, and if they played the system to their own advantage. But they're also very concerned about what oppositional forces were doing and perhaps trying to figure out a way of countering that as well.
It sounds like I've just heard a good argument for voting for Bernie Sanders. Anyway, Cleo, so what we have right now is Modi sort of clearing out the underbrush of the thicket of Indian politics and society, and it seems to be pretty dense, especially after Congress, the other party, now the opposition party, had been in power for so long. So is it going to take Modi years to do this? And once he's successful in clearing out the underbrush, will he be able to start implementing his economic reform proposals that everyone has been looking forward to? And now there's a lot of disappointment because he hasn't been able to go forward as people had thought. So what's going to happen?
I think he's everybody, you know, the people who voted for him are giving him a little bit more time because, you know, if you're in India, you know how deeply problematic the system had become. And just to give you a small idea, they arrested a guy a few years ago who was a guy from Pune who had basically no personal assets, but he had been transferring billions of dollars to Switzerland. And the reason that they can't really get at this guy is because those money laundering networks, these hawala networks that are, you know, this kind of Islamic banking hawala network, can be used to funnel black political money out, so corrupt political money out. But those same flows join the tide with criminal groups, so, you know, drugs, prostitution, whatever, and terrorism funding. So if you're a politician who's used the same person that terrorists and drug dealers use to launder your money, you're going to try to protect him from any prosecution. So as a result, you have a whole system that is protecting the criminal and terrorist elements within the society in order to protect their own illegal money, which gives you an idea of just how vicious the opposition to Modi will be to clean up the system. And the incentive to, for example, paint him as some crazy Hindu nationalist who will destroy the country and push those emotive buttons in order to get any of the corruption stuff stopped before it can touch those very deep money flows.
Cleo, Mr. Modi's a politician with sharp elbows. He didn't get into this yesterday, and he's not running for Pope. He knows what he took on.
Yes.
He beat Congress very badly, historically badly. He knows they're going to push back. Is he prepared for it? Is he fighting hard, or is he appealing to us and he wants sympathy?
He's fighting very hard, and he's keeping his head down, and he's not complaining, and he's working 18 hours a day, and he's getting the people around him to work 18 hours a day, and he's terrorizing the public service by doing things like showing up in their offices unannounced, which means they actually have to show up for work and keep their offices clean, which is kind of unprecedented. So, you know, he's, I think, doing what he can. The country is in very bad shape. He inherited a systematically difficult situation. And just to give you an idea, we talked about it very briefly last time, but there are different civil codes in the country based on your religion. So if you're a Hindu, you can have one wife. If you're a Muslim, you can have four wives. If you're a Christian, you have different inheritance laws than, you know, if you're a different religion. So, you know, he has, not only does he have this corruption roiling around, but he has societally problematic structures that some of his electorate brought him in to deal with. So he's got on all sides issues to deal with. And at the same time, he's in a highly volatile corner of the world. And he's been dealing with that by trying to consolidate relationships in the SARC region outside of Pakistan. So he's got a lot going on. And so far, the flashpoints where you can actually see whether they're effective or not, like the Nepal relief, have been very effective.
So,
much more effective than they have been in the past.
So, Cleo, we've seen Modi go across the region. We've seen him come to the United States. He's going to China in a few days. What is your report card on Modi as the external policy coin?
He's very rarely hit a false note. I mean, he's been pretty perfect, and he's very targeted. So he came to Canada, and he got his uranium deal. He went to the U.S. and energized the diaspora. He went to Germany, signed a bunch of deals there. He's very targeted about what he wants from the different countries and how that can help his own country grow. And in the context of China, there is definitely an awareness within the strategic circles in India that China is problematic. But they need investment, and there are not huge investment flows out of the West. The Japan flows are starting to increase, but they need money. They need money if the economy is going to grow, and his driving ambition is to bring the poorest Indian out of poverty. And that takes money. So he will deal with China as an economic policy, as an economic engagement, in order to help that poorest Indian who voted for him.
Cleo, right at the end, give him a letter grade, teacher. What do you think?
I think he's a B+, but maybe he's doing work on the back of the page that I haven't seen yet.
Gordon, give him a grade.
Who am I to argue with Cleo? You know, so I'll go with the B+. But I think on, for instance, external policies, I'd have to agree he's got an A or an A+ there.
Absolutely.
Cleo Pascal, Associate Fellow, Energy, Environment, and Resources at the Chatham House, Gordon Chang of Forbes.com, and my grade, B. I'm John Batchelor. I'm John Batchelor, Gordon Chang of Forbes.com. He's here with me, and we're off to Korea. We push a button and we go to Greg Scarlatu, our colleague, Executive Director of Committee for Human Rights in North Korea, writing recently for the Washington Post with his colleague Abraham Cooper, Associate Dean of the Simon Wiesenthal Center. Greg, a very good morning to you. You're writing with Mr. Cooper about a grave subject, which is the persecution and abuse and crimes by the North Korean government and its allies against the people of North Korea. We understand that a celebrity from the 20th century, Steinem, recently gained attention for a march across the DMZ. Why did she do this? And you have a much better suggestion about how Steinem can spend her time. Good morning to you.
And good evening to you, John. We all know that egregious human rights violations are happening in North Korea. A UN Commission of Inquiry has established that what the North Korean government is doing to its own people amounts to crimes against humanity. If any good were to come from this type of march, then the marchers would have to address women's rights in North Korea. They would have to address, for example, the forcible repatriation of North Korean refugees by China. They're forcibly repatriated to conditions of extreme danger in North Korea. We've had a very credible, extensive reports of North Korean women who became pregnant with Chinese men being victims of forced abortions, extreme sexual violence. We've had reports of infanticide. If such a march were to happen, the suggestion that we have is that this march should take place in China. It should be a march to the Sino-North Korean border. That's the border that so many North Koreans desperately try to cross in search of freedom, in search of a better life.
Greg, Gloria Steinem, when she crosses the DMZ, she will end up in Seoul. What is her relationship with South Korean peace activists and North Korean sympathizers in the South?
Well, I'm not sure that she's fully aware of such connections, but there have certainly been some pieces written in the press recently that such connections may exist between some of those marching alongside Ms. Steinem and such groups in South Korea.
I want to emphasize something here, just because we're talking about North Korea and the abuse of the people of North Korea. Gordon, the fact that a celebrity, once a celebrity, now a senior figure, would go to North Korea. How does this work, Gordon? Is North Korea not understood in the United States? Would this kind of foolishness be commonplace if people understood what's going on there?
Well, clearly she has the backing of the North Korean regime. Otherwise, they wouldn't allow her into North Korea. They wouldn't allow her to walk through North Korea.
That's when that basketball player was there, right? And there were a couple of other celebrities who've been invited in.
Dennis Rodman was a joke. This thing, though, is more serious because it has a chance of destabilizing the relationship between South and North Korea, creating all sorts of troubles in the South Korean state. And so, therefore, this is much more serious. You know, we can laugh at Rodman, but we certainly can't laugh at Gloria Steinem's march because there's a potential for so much that can go wrong, especially because it has the backing of the Kim regime.
Greg, your piece in the Washington Post is excellent, and Mr. Cooper is a very serious man, and this is a serious matter. The response to your piece, was it positive? Do you believe people understood?
some people understood, some people did not understand. And the reason for not understanding what is going on is basically not understanding what some of the connections are there. And, you know, I'm simply expressing my own personal views when I say that some of the members of the group have expressed views sympathetic of the North Korean regime. And once again, if the North Korean regime is interested in a peace gesture, the greatest peace gesture would be to release those hundreds of South Korean POWs they're still holding in North Korea. We are talking about old men in their 80s and 90s, many of whom have done very hard labor in mines, for example, in North Korea. So this amounts, unfortunately, to nothing but human rights theater, aiming to divert attention away from the hard human rights issues in North Korea, political prison camps, the abduction of foreign nationals, under the guise of a peace march.
Greg, your group, Committee for Human Rights in North Korea, has just issued a report on the State Department's list of state sponsors of terrorism and North Korea's basically being taken off the list in 2008. And the question about whether North Korea still is a state sponsor of terrorism. Could you talk a few seconds about that?
This report, authored by an attorney and Korea expert, Joshua Stanton, establishes that North Korea's sponsorship of terrorism is a threat to human rights in several regions of the world, including the United States. The report also determines that the applicable standards when it comes to listing a state as a sponsor of terrorism are vague and inconsistent, that the U.S. State Department reporting on terrorism has not always conformed to these standards, and that some of the consequences of North Korea's relisting as a state sponsor of terrorism would be legally and financially substantial. North Korea was removed from the list in 2008, but our report examines North Korean assassinations and kidnappings, both attempted and executed, as well as plots to commit such acts before and after 2008. This report scrutinizes also other conduct that could justify North Korea's relisting as a state sponsor of terrorism, including threats against civilian targets and terrorist financing.
Greg Scarlatu from Seoul, he's in South Korea, writing with Abraham Cooper at the Associate Dean of the Simon Wiesenthal Center about North Korea, the abuse of the people, and this final paragraph. We urge Steinem and anyone else seeking to shake up the status quo on the Korean Peninsula to march not from Pyongyang to the DMZ, but instead to stage a protest at China's border with North Korea, which so many North Koreans attempt to cross in a desperate bid to escape their repression. Put on your walking shoes, Steinem. Gordon Chang of Forbes.com. I'm John Batchelor. I'm John Batchelor with Gordon Chang. We welcome our colleague Steve Herman of the Voice of America. He's the Southeast Asia correspondent. When last we left Mr. Herman, it was a rainy morning in Nepal. He was in Kathmandu, leaving to do his reporting job that day. He was traveling outside the city. The conditions were disastrous, to make an understatement here. I've seen pictures from that day and afterwards. There was one particular photograph that was shocking, of a woman lying on the ground. She was being carried in a sling and her back was broken. That was the photograph that came up on Voice of America. So, Mr. Herman, congratulations for your very hard work, along with you and your colleagues. What you saw was a nightmare. That day, where did you travel? What did you see of the people that day? Good morning to you.
Yes, good morning, John. We ended up that day in Kavri and Sindelpachok districts, which were the two hardest hit districts, the largest number of casualties are in Sindel Palchak district. And essentially, we came across a number of villages, and they were typical of many, many more that we did not visit, where every single structure in the community had been destroyed. And most of these people, after nearly a week at that time, had really not received any aid or support whatsoever. And that was a very typical situation.
When you say didn't receive any aid, do you mean you saw no aid workers, no bottles of water, no food, no medical, in all of these destroyed areas?
Almost, yes, to the T. We had come across one remote community where they said the previous day a Singaporean medical team had come in for 15 minutes, but there were still injured, including a small baby with a broken leg who had just been left there and had no idea when they were going to get any sort of food, water, medicine. And they were quite fortunate, actually, because they had had somebody visit. But most of the places we went, there had been no one whatsoever. Or another typical situation was the Red Cross had dropped off about 90 tarps for 1,700 households, which had no shelter.
Steve, there have been many reports in Voice of America and elsewhere about governments and non-governmental organizations delivering aid and assistance, or at least delivering the aid to Nepal. Is that aid getting through to people?
Some of it is, yes, but there has been tremendous frustration expressed by members of civil society we spoke with in Nepal and the United Nations and international NGOs about the government essentially shooting itself in the foot, acting like the bureaucracy should go on as normal and everything should be checked as far as customs procedures and taxes paid as normal. And they also demanded that all donations be filtered through the Nepal Prime Minister's Disaster Relief Fund, and it would be illegal, essentially, for people to contribute directly to some of the NGOs. And we heard about cases where aid was actually taken away from groups or individuals by government officials because they thought that they should be in charge of the distribution. Yes, there was some corruption. Yes, there's some extortion. Yes, there are all sorts of bureaucratic Kafkaesque procedures. That's normal in Nepal. And what essentially happened, despite pledges from the government that they should be on a war footing to respond to this earthquake, the government, to a great degree, went ahead like it was business as usual. And the results were that of that were just a catastrophe atop a disaster.
After the disaster relief is finished and all the teams go home, and after they start rebuilding, will there be political consequences for the government's disastrous handling of this?
Yeah, that remains to be seen. Certainly the people from the middle class and upper class we were talking to in Kathmandu, who had organized their own aid efforts, said that things would have to change. And if the government didn't get its act together very quickly, it would be held accountable. Now, whether that's just frustration or these people will actually be spurred into creating their own political parties or movements, as we've seen in places like India in recent years, we don't know. Politics is a very fractious and dirty business in Nepal, and there are no indications yet that that will change. You have weak, corrupt governance after a long period of a civil war, and people, professionals in South Asia, tend not to want to get their hands dirty with getting into politics.
Because you very carefully reported that there are goods and water and an enormous amount of supplies coming into the airport. Is that leaving the airport? Is it going to warehouses? Is there a distribution system? And I've seen this, it's just an anecdote on Twitter. You understand, Steve, I don't trust anything. The warehouses are filling up with supplies that are not to be distributed. They're to be resold. Did you see anything like that?
There's definitely some cases like that. And in one fishing village, Majigong, that we were in, the people had gone to the nearest town, and the aid supplies had already been taken by relatively well-off shopkeepers And there was some also anecdotal evidence that some of this may have been for sale. It's not efficient by any means, but it is much, much better than it was in the immediate days after the earthquake. But still, the fact that Nepal may perhaps concerned about its sovereignty, being that it's sandwiched between China and India, and it's very insecure about that, trying to assert some semblance of sovereignty by, you know, inspecting everything and in the eyes of international NGOs, giving them a really hard time. And also, the rescue teams were told after a week, go home. We can handle everything in Kathmandu, and it's typical after one of these disasters for the search and rescue teams to pull out after a week. In other words, a tremendous amount of nervousness among the government for having such a large military and international NGO presence in the country, although they desperately need this.
Did you see any evidence of looting or law-breaking in Kathmandu, or did you hear stories about the about violence?
We definitely saw people in a bit of a panic, fighting with each other over getting tarps and water, but no widespread looting or lawlessness. Obviously, there's a concern about that. But all in all, the Nepalese people seem to be extremely stoic in this situation, and they're the ones who are coming together to help themselves and help others, and really a lot of criticism being leveled at the government for its inefficiency, to put it mildly.
So essentially what you're saying is that communities have sort of given up on the government and now have realized that if they're going to be any help, it has to come from within. Is that what you're saying?
Except for, I think, some of these villages where we saw where they had absolutely nothing left. Their livestock were buried under the rubble, which, besides their homes, was the most valuable thing that they had, and they had no food and water. And they're upset with the government and still hoping to get anything from anybody. But if you're talking about Nepalese civil society, they're definitely not sitting around waiting for the government to do something. They have taken matters into their own hands. These are, even though these people may have lost loved ones and their homes have been destroyed or damaged, they were coming together at ad hoc aid stations, collecting supplies, donating money, and organizing shipments of trucks. And one NGO head that we spoke with, she was so worried about her supplies being intercepted that she had villagers lining the roadsides to protect these caravans of caravan of seven trucks taking aid to Gurkha province. These are the types of things that people have to do if they want to ensure that the aid is going to reach its destination and get to the people who really need it.
The report said the airport had doubled its traffic and was overwhelmed. What did you see while you were there, Steve?
Oh, this is, you've got to understand, you're talking about a one-runway airport in the Himalayan foothills with only nine landing bays, a damaged runway that could not handle these heavy aircraft coming in. At one point, a couple of days ago, they actually had to shut down the airport again and repair the runway. And all it would take is one minor mishap, as we've had one of these recently with a Turkish Airlines plane before the earthquake, to shut down the airport for days, and that would just essentially stop all the aid coming in, except for some trickles by land routes. So that airport is by no means set up to handle anything like this. And air traffic control was overwhelmed. There was just no organization on the ground for handling all these aircraft. It's the only international airport for Nepal. So I think we've been very, very fortunate that there hasn't been something worse happen at the airport.
Just a final thought. What we've seen before in these earthquake disasters is the immediate concentration of aid and help, and yet it's a month or two later that things begin to deteriorate again because the services haven't returned and the people are overwhelmed. Do you sense that that's possible in Nepal? Or are they, as you say, they're going to take care of themselves and ignore the government?
Well, I think it's possible, but we have a number of highly committed international NGOs that are very experienced with this, that have been in Nepal, such as Plan International for some years, or others coming in, Mercy Corps, Catholic Relief Services, doing wonderful jobs on the ground, as well as USAID, which is committed more than $11 million at this point. So I'm cautiously optimistic that if Nepal's government just sort of gets out of the way and let these international NGOs who are very experienced do their thing, Nepal has a chance to come out of this.
Steve Herman of the Voice of America, Gordon Chang of Forbes.com. I'm John Batchelor. I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. April 2012, presidential election year. The Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, President of the United States, running very hard and would be very successful winning a re-election. China, the rising power, the relationship between Washington and Beijing at this moment looked positive and supportive, mutually supportive. And then Gordon Chang of Forbes.com is here with me, and we're joined by David Feith of the Wall Street Journal editorial board. He is in Hong Kong. David reviewed a book published this winter, The Barefoot Lawyer, A Blind Man's Fight for Justice and Freedom in China. The author is now in the United States and safe. His name is Chen Guangcheng. He's blind. He's a human rights lawyer. That's what you need to know. What he campaigned for was the dignity of people in rural China, especially women, to have children and not to be abused and tormented by the government. However, Mr. Chen Guangcheng, now in the United States, has published his memoir. And we asked David's help for a discrepancy between Mr. Chen Guangcheng, a man who suffered abuse and escaped from the Chinese Communist Party, and Hillary Clinton, now candidate for the presidency of the United States, writing of this incident in her memoir, Hard Choices, published in 2014. David, a very good morning to you in Hong Kong. Chen Guangcheng tells a very different story than Mrs. Clinton. He escaped. He made his way to the U.S. Embassy in Beijing. And then what happened? What does he believe happened? What does he believe was a risk for him? Good morning.
Good morning. Well, this was a very dramatic story. As you say, Chen Guangcheng was a blind human rights lawyer. He was imprisoned for several years. And then in 2012, he had been under house arrest in his rural village for another few years, surrounded by layers of police and unofficial security agents, keeping himself and his family basically isolated from the world. He escaped this government cordon and was taken to Beijing, where he went into the U.S. embassy. He happened to do this days before Hillary Clinton was coming into Beijing for high-level talks with the Chinese government. And basically what happened then is he sought to either stay in the embassy or emigrate from China with his family for asylum in the United States. But while he was in the embassy, initially the U.S. officials treated him very nicely and essentially were following his lead. And then, as he describes in great detail in this memoir, within about 2 days, the U.S. officials changed their position and started negotiating very nervously with the Chinese government, and then basically started pressuring Mr. Chen to do as the Chinese government wanted, which would not have allowed him to leave China, where he had been tormented for so many years by the government. And his account of this differs, as you say, from Hillary Clinton's. In her memoir, she says that she and her staff, quote, did what Chen said he wanted every step of the way. But most of this memoir disagrees with that in great detail.
David, is this a question of American embassy officials in Beijing making bad decisions? Or really was this a case of American officials making decisions that were consistent with the general tone of U.S. policy with regard to China?
It's a very interesting question, and it's hard to say exactly, because this is only one case. And as you suggest, the U.S. has a history of
making bad decisions.
Of some soft diplomacy toward the Chinese government. So you could say this is just another illustration of that. But what's interesting, and what certainly comes to light in Chen Guangcheng's memoir, is the degree to which these sorts of events really are a function of a few individuals, in this case, senior U.S. State Department officials, making decisions. And they could have decided any of a few ways over the few days when this crisis in the Beijing embassy was developing. And what he describes quite clearly is that the initial reaction of some of the staffers at the embassy was very sympathetic and very much to defend his rights and to seek to vindicate them against the Chinese government that had abused him. And then basically when the White House and then when Hillary Clinton got involved, the U.S. position changed and they sought to settle a compromise with the Chinese government that would have left Mr. Chen and his family in a very precarious situation.
David, since this time, there's been a noticeable change in the views in Washington and elsewhere about China, certainly a much more darker views. Do you think that American embassy officials would have made the same, would make the same mistakes today? Or do you think that the, basically the policy consistency just hasn't changed since 2012?
It's interesting. It's hard to imagine exactly this circumstance happening again. It was quite unusual, except that, of course, if you look over the course of decades, there were similar cases. There were cases like this in the Soviet Union, and there was a very prominent case in 1989 when a senior Chinese dissident also went and demanded asylum and refuge at the U.S. Embassy in Beijing. If this were to happen again today, it would, again, it would seem be up to the senior leadership of the U.S. government. Of course, the president has not changed. John Kerry would perhaps take the lead in the way that Hillary Clinton did again, and it's hard to know. What's interesting is exactly as you say, U.S. thinking officially and unofficially on China has changed some in recent years, but it seems that the change is more concerning frustration, for example, with Chinese cyber theft and aggressive Chinese territorial assertiveness in the Western Pacific. It's not clear that the U.S. has decided, this administration, to take a more open and aggressive policy toward highlighting the Chinese human rights issue. That's something where they know it would anger the Chinese government because the Chinese government feels very vulnerable on these issues. And in that sense, this administration has been consistent over its years in not raising the cases, for example, of the jailed Nobel Peace Prize winner Liu Xiaobo or of his wife Liu Xia, who was under illegal house arrest for about 5 years since he was given the Nobel Prize, or many others, including lawyers like Gao Jisheng and others who have left prison and, for example, asked to go overseas for medical treatment that the Chinese government is denying them. The U.S. has not been making cases of these individuals, and in that sense, the policy today looks a lot like the policy in 2012 when this Chen Guangcheng episode took place.
Does Chen Guangcheng believe that if he had stayed in China, he'd be dead?
He doesn't quite put it that way, if I remember his writing correctly, but he writes perfectly clearly that he would have been at the mercy of the Chinese government, and in particularly sensitive cases like his, lawyers and activists and others in his position have met all kinds of terrible fates, from imprisonment to torture and otherwise. He and his family would have very much been at risk, and part of the tragedy of this story is that while in the immediate term, he and his immediate family, that is his wife and I believe two children, were able to leave China, and they've been in the United States for 3 years now. His extended family mostly remained
David
in
Fife
China
in Hong Kong. Gordon Chang, I'm John Batchelor.